Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Coming up on the broadcast today, an economic slice of Black History Month, our weekly partnership with Gallup Attitude Check, we call it, and how Fashion Week in New York City can actually be soothing. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Let Marketplace be your guide to the modern world. Subscribe to the Marketplace Tech Report podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace podcast for Thursday, the 16th of February. Good as always to have you with us. And we are, as of today, a little bit more than halfway through Black History Month. Proclamations and resolutions by presidents and congresses going back decades set aside the month of February as a time for us to increase our awareness of African Americans and our shared history, which of course means that every February companies roll out ads linking the achievements of Black Americans to everything from Heineken to Harley's. But here's a slightly less cynical note. What began in 1926 as Negro History Week is now one of the busiest and most lucrative months for Black professionals on the public speaking circuit. Christopher Johnson reports.
Book Maya Angelou to come speak at your company or college. Trust me, because when the 83-year-old poet, author, and civil rights icon gets on the mic, or even on the telephone, she turns it on.
I speak about people who were chained and dared to live and sang songs like, by and by, I'm gonna lay down this heavy load. Amazing.
Even more amazing, Angelou says, will be the day when Black history and Black speakers become popular year-round.
The celebrities will be more sought after in June and then in October. And they wouldn't all be jammed up together in one month.
But till then, for the distinguished and less famous Black speaker, February pays. George Curry is a syndicated columnist and former editor of the Black news magazine, Emerge.
On the speaking circuit, we have a joke. We call it Black Employment Month because some people will hire Black speakers in February and no other time throughout the year.
Curry's not complaining, not a lot. He earns a nice slice of his living this month, on the road, behind podiums. Business is also sweet this time of year for booking agents. Bob Davis is senior vice president of the American Program Bureau, the folks who handled Martin Luther King's speaking gigs. Today's roster includes Julian Bond, Michael Eric Dyson, and Patti LaBelle. APB's college division sees a big spike in February.
Maybe a third of the annual business is done in a month. You can fill somebody's dance card pretty full during the month of February.
That could mean 3 weeks of appearances at universities, corporate events, and nonprofit functions. At $30,000 a speech for featured talent, let me just do some figuring here. Whoa. $630,000.
Public speaking pays very, very well, and you would never think that you could make this kind of money.
Curry and Maya Angelou agree Black speakers should just be seen as speakers who have valuable things to say throughout the year. But until Black history truly goes 365, February can be pretty, pretty good for Black talent. In Oakland, I'm Christopher Johnson for Marketplace.
This was a pretty good day on Wall Street. All three major indices finished in the money. We'll have the details in a song that goes like that when we do the numbers. If ever there was a case of being able to see the glass as either half empty or half full, today's profit report from General Motors was it. Take your choice, if you like, of these two very different headlines, both of which, by the way, are true. On the one hand, GM posted a record profit of more than $9 billion last year. On the other, GM's fourth quarter earnings fell short of analysts' estimates. So riddle me this. Who exactly are those analysts, and what do they know anyway? Here's our senior business correspondent, Bob Moon.
Way back in 1933, a Harvard economist posed the question, can stock market forecasters forecast? His study concluded, it is doubtful. Fast forward, and little seems to have changed. Was GM's profit really too weak, or did analysts just get it wrong?
The reality is, this is a company that was on its knees just a couple years ago. And to be talking about record profits is what we really need to focus on.
Rebecca Lindland is an auto industry analyst for IHS Global, but she focuses on things like consumer satisfaction and doesn't make stock predictions. She says her Wall Street counterparts are merely making educated guesses. They talk to company managers, suppliers, and customers and come up with their estimate. GM came in below the consensus this time around. Of the S&P 500 companies that have reported so far this quarter, though, two-thirds have beat expectations.
Too high to be an accident. Management has gotten so good at downplaying expectations that they leave themselves a lot of room to surprise to the upside.
Economist Barry Ritholtz contends corporate executives have learned to influence the analyst numbers with a wink and a nod.
You know, your numbers, you're way up there. You need to settle down a little bit. We're not selling iPads. We're selling, you know, dishwashing detergent. You got to lower your numbers a little bit.
Ritholtz says in some cases, analysts can skew their numbers higher to improve sales for their investment banking firms. Those banks promised to wall off their research divisions years ago, but many on Wall Street say the cheerleading goes on. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
Here's a familiar name you might not see in lights next week at the Academy Awards, Kodak. A bankruptcy judge says Kodak can, as it requested, end its $74 million naming rights deal for the Hollywood Theater that hosts the Oscars. The Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences is said to be considering moving future ceremonies to other high-profile venues, including downtown L.A.'s Nokia Theater. You know, Nokia, the cell phone maker that's not doing so well? Coincidence or the perils of pricey sponsorship deals? Marketplace's Sally Herships has more.
They call it the stadium curse. Remember PSI? Probably not.
They were an internet service provider.
David Rogers teaches branding at Columbia.
And obviously they didn't last at the internet boom. That's why you can't remember the name.
PSI paid millions in the late 90s to have its name put on the stadium where the Baltimore Ravens play. Then the company went bankrupt. And there are many other sad corporate stories. Transworld Dome, Wachovia Center, and Enron Field.
I mean, by now, I think it should be clear that this is a gamble.
Prashant Malviya teaches marketing at Georgetown. He says the millions spent by companies on sponsorship deals like these should have been invested more wisely, like in traditional advertising. And he says consumers don't like show-offy companies anyway.
If they would just call it America Stadium rather than Bank of America Stadium, it would take away all this, the show-off nature of the corporation trying to, you know, put its big name out there.
David Rogers says it's important for stadiums and other spaces to make sure a new name is the right fit, because they may be stuck with the name for a while. Take Harvard Law. The school sold rights all over a new building. One donor gave the law school $100,000 in honor of his father. Harvard named the restroom after him. His name is spelled F-A-L-I-K.
And so Mr. Fralick had always had trouble trying to find a real estate property that he could put his own name on. So there's now the Fralick Men's Room.
No way.
Yes way.
Even if Mr. Fralick goes bankrupt, the law school bathroom can hold on to its name. In New York, I'm Sally Herships from Marketplace.
I'm sorry. They are totally making that one up. Anyway, moving on. Debt collectors and credit reporting agencies are about to get a serious look from federal regulators. Today, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau announced a plan to keep tabs on agencies that have, until now, largely escaped government supervision. That means Experian, Equifax, TransUnion, and nearly 200 debt collection agencies in all. Marketplace's Jennifer Collins has that story.
The announcement puts the three largest credit reporting agencies and a host of debt collectors on alert. Karen Petru is with Federal Financial Analytics.
These companies have never, ever had to open their doors to federal gumshoes.
So then credit reporting agencies and debt collectors may be kind of shaking in their boots today?
I think they are.
The Consumer Financial Protection Bureau says the three major credit reporting agencies maintain information on 200 million Americans. 30 million Americans have debt under collection, and this proposal would scrutinize agencies that control two-thirds of the collections. Kathleen Day of the Center for Responsible Lending says it's about time.
There's a lot of shenanigans. People are threatened that they owe stuff that they really don't owe. They're told that, you know, bad things will happen that won't happen.
But James Angel, a finance professor at Georgetown University, says more regulation is not always the answer.
The worst case scenario is that the regulators dump a bunch of bureaucracy on the firms. that really does nothing to help the consumer.
The proposal is open for comment for about 2 months. I'm Jennifer Collins for Marketplace.
The president's budget that came out this week is what you might politely call a planning document. Political realities in Congress mean it's not actually going to pass, but it does seem fair to ask, given the dollar amounts involved and the fact that it's your money, how do you really feel about it?
And the latest poll numbers suggest margin of error.
There is somewhat of a disconnect.
It's conventional wisdom.
Our survey said...
Attitude Check is what we call our partnership with Gallup. Frank Newport, the editor-in-chief, is with us every week to help us understand what Americans really think. Frank, good to talk to you again.
Hi, good to be with you.
So let's talk about the budget for a minute. And let me ask you, based on the polling you have done, what do Americans want the government to spend more on, just for starters?
Well, the American public actually likes the government spending more on anything that relates to jobs. Plus, education is actually at the top of this one list we gave them of eight things. Yes, Americans say that's great that the government spend money on education. The military, Social Security, and Medicare, Homeland Security, even aid to farmers, and in one list, even aid to arts and sciences. Hmm. Americans said, yes, that's something good that the government should be doing.
What do they want us to spend less on? I mean, what do they want to cut out of the budget? Do you know?
Well, that's difficult. You can ask some questions and they'll say spend less on, for example, trying to reduce income inequality, some more broad things along these lines. Republicans, of course, say spend less on trying to intrude health care control mm-hmm. into our lives. But the problem is that when you give Americans lists of things, they kind of like them all.
Yeah.
In fact, we gave them a list of about eight things, and the only thing that less than majority said they like the government doing is foreign aid. They're willing to cut foreign aid.
What about the deficit, though? You know, you and I have talked before about how a deficit's right up on the top of the list of things Americans are worried about, and this is a budget that comes in at $3.8 trillion with annual deficits for a couple of years of $1 trillion. You know, I mean, what do we think of that?
Americans are worried about the deficit in general, and in general, Americans are worried about big government. They're worried about government spending. But then when you list things individually one by one, as we've been talking about, Americans say, well, I like that, or don't cut that. So it's a central paradox. It's very difficult to solve short-term versus long-term. And clearly, President Obama and his advisors for the first year of his budget said, we'll look at the short-term. We'll focus on giving Americans these ideas about spending money to help increase jobs and do wonderful things.
Right. I wonder if we can end perhaps on a happy note. You and I have spoken before about how Americans are fed up with the partisanship in Washington and how they just want people to agree in Washington on what would be best for the country. And this week we saw, lo and behold, Congress potentially listening, a deal on the payroll tax cut and extension of unemployment benefits. It's a curious thing that this is happening now.
Well, I'm not sure it's so curious because I think members of Congress have been reading our polls. No question about it. You're absolutely right. Every poll I've seen said yes to the payroll tax extension and yes to extending unemployment benefits, and that's exactly what's happened. I think members of Congress on both sides of the aisle saw what happened last August when they dithered up to the last minute on the expansion of the debt ceiling. So now they've said, hey, we better do something to show some cooperation. I think the American public will be very, very pleased and positive about what's happening in terms of this agreement.
Fascinating stuff. Frank Newport is the editor-in-chief at Gallup. Our partnership with them is called Attitude Check. You can read more about it and the data from Gallup's polling on our website. It's marketplace.org. Frank, we'll see you next week.
Great.
Coming up, fashion as a safety blanket.
That's a kind of trend that's sort of comforting and cozy and retreating from, you know, this unstable moment in the economy.
But first, let's do the numbers. Yeah, so here comes that phrase again. Today's economic readings were better than analyst estimates, and that helped push the blue chips toward their highest close in almost 4 years. The Dow Industrials packed on 123 points, nearly 1%, finished at 12,904. The NASDAQ Composite bounced 44 points, better than 1.5%, 29.59 at the bell. The S&P 500 climbed 14 points, 1.1%. The final number there, 1358. Never mind the General Motors quarterly performance didn't meet analyst estimates. Shares of the recovering automaker still revved up more than 9% on its record annual profit. Financial stocks led the way for blue chips. Bank of America checked in with a gain of nearly 4% today. Bond prices dropped, pushed the yield on 10-year treasuries up to 1.98%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Do you enjoy the music we play between stories? Visit the Marketplace Music section to browse playlists for all of our programs and to buy those songs on Amazon. A percentage of each purchase goes towards supporting our programs. Find more online at marketplace.org/music.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. In Washington, the Labor Department releases its Consumer Price Index for January. President Obama visits Washington State to speak at Boeing's assembly plant. And future Chinese President Xi Jinping meets with Vice President Joe Biden in Los Angeles. I'm Justin Ho.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdal. It's been the conventional wisdom for a good couple of years now that President Obama's prospects for continued employment rest largely with the unemployment rate and consumer confidence. Commentator Megan McArdle says just because things are looking up, that doesn't mean the president gets the credit.
Over the past several months, the GOP candidates have done their best to link President Obama with the economy in voters' minds. And why not? Tens of millions are still out of work, and while growth may be picking up, it's still not fast enough to repair resumes or credit scores. But Mitt Romney should have thought twice before he claimed that Obama had made the recession worse. The reason is, it just isn't true. There is just no evidence that the economy would have been any stronger today under President John McCain. Hold on, Democrats. There's no reason to think it would be any weaker either. The fact is that presidents have remarkably little control over the economy. Economists just don't know that much about what mix of policies makes economies grow. The best presidents can do is something like Obama's massive stimulus package. But fiscal stimulus doesn't grow the underlying economy as much as borrow some growth from the future. Frankly, we should be glad that presidents don't have that kind of power. You wouldn't like living in an economy that was prone to radical shifts every time a new president was elected. Unfortunately for Obama, voters tend to put a human face on large and personal forces. We can't get mad at technological progress that destroys low-skilled jobs, and so instead we get mad at the president. But don't feel too sorry for him. After all, when he was campaigning in 08, Obama frequently complained that President Bush had driven the economy into a ditch. And Obama promised that he would drive it out again. Even after he was elected, he told NBC's Matt Lauer, "If I don't have this done in 3 years, then there's going to be a one-term proposition." We'd probably all be better off if voters didn't assume that presidents can fix the economy. And we'd definitely be better off if presidential candidates didn't tell them so.
Megan McArdle is a business writer at The Atlantic magazine. Your thoughts? Send them to us online. Marketplace.org is the website. Click on the link that says contact. If all the rumors you read on the internet are right, and yes, I know rumors on the internet, but if they are, Apple's going to release the latest incarnation of the iPad in a couple of weeks, unless a small technology company in Hong Kong has its way. ProView Technology claims it owns the legal rights to the name iPad in China. A judge over there has already sided with ProView. Apple's appealing, but in the meanwhile, ProView wants to block all shipments of the iPad 3. Our China correspondent Rob Schmitz has the story from Shanghai.
When Apple decided it wanted to name its new tablet the iPad, it went from country to country to buy the naming rights. Apple lawyers thought the Taiwanese arm of ProView Technology owned the China rights. But the China rights to the name iPad were not owned by ProView's Taiwan arm. They were owned by ProView's branch in mainland China, says ProView lawyer Xiao Taiyuan.
Apple thinks it owns the rights to the iPad name in China, but Apple bought the rights from the wrong party.
A Chinese judge has agreed, ruling against Apple. But ProView is under scrutiny, too. The company, which is seeking up to $1.6 billion from Apple, is reportedly in debt. When reporters visited its China headquarters recently, they found an abandoned factory. Still, ProView is seeking to halt all exports of the new iPad from China. China consultant Bill Bishop writes the tech blog DigiChina. He says halting exports of one of the world's most hyped-up products is a tall order.
Frankly, I think the Chinese government wouldn't want that because if they were to ban the export of the iPad, then they would shut down have to shut down some production lines and a lot of people will be out of work.
But that doesn't mean Apple won't have to change the iPad's name inside the China market. Authorities in some Chinese cities have ordered retailers to stop selling the iPad because of the dispute. In the end, though, legal experts guess that Apple may likely dip into its billions to settle the dispute. In Shanghai, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
On the better-than-even chance that you've never heard of the Heartland Institute, based out of Chicago, it's a free-market think tank that is generally opposed to environmental regulations. This week, somebody posing as a Heartland insider leaked a bunch of company documents. Among other secrets, the paper trail listed Heartland's donors, many of them well-known corporations, corporations which are now on the environmental defensive. Marketplace's Amy Scott reports.
A leaked fundraising plan lists Microsoft, GlaxoSmithKline, Comcast, and AT&T among the Heartland Institute's donors. The document says they funded the group's technology and healthcare newsletters. But Heartland is best known for its efforts to discredit climate science, says Joe Rome, a climate change activist with the Center for American Progress.
If that's their main mission or a core mission, then, I think people should think twice about supporting, even ancillary work.
The Heartland Institute did not respond to Marketplace's requests for information. On its website, the group said one of the documents was a total fake and that others may have been altered. But Heartland did apologize to its donors. Kurt Whedon consults companies on corporate philanthropy. He says the connection with Heartland could come back to bite those donors.
That's a lesson learned. In the future, the implications of any commitment that's made by a corporation to a nonprofit organization has to be thought through thoroughly.
Some companies tried to distance themselves from Heartland's controversial work today. In an email, GlaxoSmithKline said, "We absolutely do not endorse or support their views on the environment or climate change." Microsoft said its nearly $60,000 gift is the retail value of donated software. The free software program is open to any nonprofit. A spokesman said hundreds of environmental groups have received the same deal. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
This is Fashion Week in New York City. Runway models, big parties, expensive clothes. Not the kinds of things that 3 or 4 years of a down economy are naturally conducive to. With signs of economic life, though, do better times in high style come as well? As always, when we have questions about fashion and the business thereof, we call fashion writer Kate Betts. Hey, Kate, how are you?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm all right. So what's the vibe?
So the vibe is that people are still a little bit nervous about the economy, even though there's a lot of talk about a recovery.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you're seeing a little bit of the trend on the runway reflecting that, because we're seeing what I have identified two trends. One is the comfort trend. We're seeing a lot of blanket coats and fur vests.
Blanket coats? What?
I know. That sounds weird, doesn't it? Okay, let me back up here.
I love when you said, "I know." It's like, sorry.
Well, what I mean by blanket coats are, those sort of plaid, thick cashmere coats that look almost like they're thrown over your shoulder.
Uh-huh.
Some of them even have fringe. We saw them at Michael Kors yesterday morning.
Oh, I know Michael Kors. I do my Project Runway.
Yeah. See?
There you go.
So that's a kind of trend that's sort of comforting and cozy and retreating from, this unstable moment in the economy.
You mentioned fur, too.
Fur, a lot of fur. A lot of people at the tents wearing fur vests and fur coats.
Really? Aren't fur vests like so 1981?
Well, no, actually fur has become kind of like the new accessory. It's kind of, designers, I think, create a lot of it because they can sell it as an item, like a handbag or a shoe, a fur vest,
All right. So what's trend? What's trend number two?
Trend number two is what I call the optimistic trend. It's very polished, dressed-up clothes. A lot of designers kind of sell what they call investment pieces. They know that people need clothes for work. They need suits. They need jackets. They need coats for the winter. So that we're seeing a lot of that in a very polished, almost dressed-up way at Donna Karan, at Michael Kors, again, even at designers like Ralph Lauren this morning, a lot of tweed jackets, very
shocking,
tailored.
Ralph Lauren and tweed, right? I wanted to ask you about this other thing that I've seen. It's called, what's it called? Advanced Contemporary? What the heck is that?
Advanced Contemporary is actually the area of the market in fashion that's probably the most exciting right now because it's a lower price point and more people can afford it. And there's more fashion at that price point. It kind of sits between the
the sort of Zara and H&M and the high end. It's brands like Tory Burch, J. Crew, Theory, and all of these brands are now showing in Lincoln Center at the 10th. So they're getting a sort of fashion edge to them, and those are kind of the shows that people are excited about and where people are going to look for trends because those are the clothes that people can afford to buy.
Also, J. Crew, Michelle Obama, right?
Michelle Obama, people have familiarity with it. I think from J. Crew, we're seeing increasing fashion trends. You know, it used to be kind of the preppy brand with a lot of bright cashmere sweaters, but now it's much more fashion forward. It's an interesting thing that the price point of fashion has really lowered in terms of where the trends are.
Kate Betts, her book about Michelle Obama, as it turns out, is called Everyday Icon. Kate, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Kai.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today from the Marketplace desk of, wait, can't they put two and two together themselves? You know how most probably, of states have laws against texting while you're driving? Transportation Secretary Ray LaHood said today he wants car makers to come up with devices that would disable access to Facebook and Twitter while people are driving. Facebook, while you're driving. Put the phones down. People, both hands on the wheel, all right? Okay, we got to go. That's Marketplace from APM. Today, the Dow gained 123 points, just under 1%. The NASDAQ up 44 points, 1.5%. The S&P 500 packed on 14 points. That's about 1.1%. Ben Adair, John Buckley, Nancy Fargali, Stephen Gregory, John Haas, Jonathan Karp, Sylvester Monroe, Betsy Streisand, Lisa Tucker, and Celeste Wesson are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is George Judson. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Do hope you can join us back here tomorrow. This is APM. That's American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.